dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, I'm going to devote the entirety of the program again to reading from Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. The mark of how lost our society is can be seen in the fact that almost nobody has ever heard of this book, when its contents should be a topic of discussion in every bar and cafe, instead of whatever nonsense is mostly being talked about. So now I'm reading it to you, and you can talk about it. Reading this book is sometimes hard for me because I have to stop, because I'm crying, not out of grief, but of joy, that someone has finally written a book about how I have felt all my life. And the realization that I'm not alone and that so many people feel what I feel, even if they have no words to talk about it. They feel, we feel, that something terrible is wrong with our society, that something is missing, in spite of the fact we're told that we live in the most wonderful country, in the most wonderful time in the history of humanity. To me, it has seemed ugly and horrible since as far back as I can remember, which is about the age of 3 years old. I always felt when I was growing up that I was the only person who felt this way. I remember when I was very small, I did not want to be a little girl, and I did not want to grow up to be a big girl. I did not even want to be a human being. Somehow, probably on television, I saw an image of wild horses running, and I wanted to be a horse. I even made people call me horse for a while. I did not want to be a woman in a girdle talking out about dresses, or a man in a suit talking about his bosses. At that time, there were a lot of westerns, TV shows and movies, and the kids used to play cowboys and Indians. But I only wanted to play Indians, because it was obvious that the cowboys were bad guys. You could tell, because when they went to the gunfight, there was always a close shot of their boots walking on the ground with their spurs jangling. And that showed that they were evil, because they wore those spurs to torture horses. And also in other movies, they chased wild horses and put nooses around their necks. And the only way the horses would carry them was if they hurt them and tied them up. But the horses carried the Indians without any of those things because they loved them, because they were beautiful, just like the horses. Their hair was long and flowing like a mane, and they had beautiful designs on their face and feathers and beautiful singing and dancing around the fire. Of course, I did not know they weren't real Indians. I know I have Native people who listen to this show, so I ask you please to understand that I mean no mockery or disrespect, but quite the opposite. I didn't know that there even were real Indians, because all the people that seemed beautiful to me, Indians, pirates, and Robin Hood, all seemed to have lived in the past. And all that seemed were left were men in ugly suits and ties with no hair, and women who looked equally awful. This was the early 1960s. A while ago, I played a series of talks of Onondaga elders and other Haudenosaunee talking about the Onondaga's attempt to regain control of their ancestral lands so they can remove the poisons dumped all over the Syracuse area by our perverted culture. At one of those talks in the lobby, I met a Mohawk woman, and she was talking about how she had been subjected to Christianization as a child, and how all the movies in Hollywood had denigrated Indians and made her ashamed of her heritage. And I had to tell her that I didn't mean to minimize what she had gone through, but that oddly enough, all of the TV shows I saw with the Indians, I thought the Indians were wonderful. And of course, I've since realized something, and in Charles Eisenstein's book has made me realize it, that the people who made those shows thought the Indians were wonderful too. Otherwise, they couldn't have made them so fabulous. But of course, they had to pretend like they thought the Indians were the bad guys, because you were supposed to think the Indians were bad and the cowboys were good. But somebody on that film crew didn't believe that either. I'm telling this story because to me it relates directly to what Charles Eisenstein is talking about, and we'll explore further in this week's material, which I think is amazing. He's going to talk about the real meaning of the Garden of Eden, how we suffer longing for it. He's going to talk of play and the universe and the world of the machine and how art was demeaned into work. Then I heard about Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, and it made no sense to me at all. I couldn't understand why it was bad to know the difference between good and evil, or why it was bad to want to know anything. Wasn't I going to school so that I could learn things? And it seemed to me that going to school was good, or so my parents clearly thought. And I really couldn't understand how knowing about good and evil could make you ashamed to be naked. My dog wasn't ashamed, and horses weren't ashamed. And if we were made in the image of God, as they claimed, then why should we be ashamed of it? My parents weren't ashamed to be naked. I couldn't understand how anyone could tell such a dumb story. And it is a dumb story, and that's because it is a corrupted story, like an old computer file that has become garbled. This week, you'll hear what the actual story was more like. The version that the Yuroks still tell, who have it right, who understand why religion was invented. Eisenstein will explain that it was meant to be and means a tying back to the happiness we felt when we were still like other animals, before we began the ascent of humanity, the ascent into abstraction in the human realm. During this ascent, we have gained much and also lost much. But Eisenstein's vision is not a linear one of a paradise forever lost, but a promise of in some way completing a full circle. Last week, I read about the various technologies of mind that have introduced levels of abstraction that separate us from direct experience as part of nature. The use of language, the use of numbers, the measuring of time among them. During the ascent of humanity, we have developed these technologies to create and expand a human realm. And along this journey, this realm has increasingly divorced itself from the natural world and increasingly emulated the paradigm of the machine. But this paradigm has gone as far as it can go. And that is the topic of Eisenstein's book. To go from what he calls the age of separation to the age of reunion. We'll go into the reading with a piece of music by the Diné folk musician Sharon Birch, who was said part of an ancient ceremony to modern music. Some of the words in her song are from the Blessing Way ceremony, which is used to bring a person back into harmony, which is the same as beauty. The words Ojonahastli mean in beauty, it is finished.
Nahastan, begite, khaitna. اکنه هستن دیگنا بانس دیکیس و جنه هستلی و جنه هستلی و جنه هستلی و جنه هستلی Nahastan Bigit day Quite na Akona hastan Diyeno Bansi day case Wajona hastli Wajona hastli Wajona hastli Wajona hastli Nahastan Biyete Kwaitna Ako Nahastan Diyeno Ban Sede Kes Wajon Hasli Wajon Hasli
Marvelous Paraha. Some months after writing the rest of this chapter, I came across the work of Daniel Everett, a linguist who has spent more than a decade studying the language and culture of the Paraha. The Paraha, a small tribe of hunter-gatherers in Brazil, have resisted, with breathtaking consistency, all the developments in linguistic abstraction, representational art, number, and time described above. While this tribe has been in contact with other Brazilians for two centuries, for some reason they have maintained an extreme degree of linguistic and cultural integrity, remaining monolingual to this day. Significantly, in not just one, but all the areas described in this chapter, they exhibit very little of the separation implicit in modern symbolic culture. They do not impose linearity onto time. They do not abstract the specific into the generic through numbering. They do not usually genericize individual human beings through pronouns. They do not freeze time into representation through drawing. They do not reduce the continuum of color to a discrete finitude by naming colors. They have little independent concept of fingers, the basis for number, grasping, and controlling, nor do they use fingers to point. Most strikingly, the Piraha are unable to count. Not only do they have no words for numbers, their language also lacks any quantifiers such as many, some, or all. Even more amazing, they apparently are incapable of even learning to count. Despite 8 months of sustained efforts, speech pathologist Peter Gordon failed to teach them, even with the Piraha's enthusiastic cooperation. They cannot mimic a series of knocks because they cannot keep count of how many there have been. The Piraha language is nearly devoid of any sort of abstraction. There is no semantic embedding, as in locutions like, "I think she wants to come." "She wants to come" is a nominalized phrase embedded in "I think." The lack of nominalized phrases means that words are not abstracted from reality to be conceived as things in themselves. Grammar is not an infinitely extendable template that can generate meaning abstractly through mere syntax. Words are used only in concrete reference to objects of direct experience. There are, for example, no myths of any sort in Piraha, nor do the Piraha tell fictional stories. This absence of abstraction also explains the lack of terms for numbers. Even colors do not exist in the abstract for Piraha. While they are clearly able to discern colors and use words like blood or dirt as modifiers to describe colored objects, these words do not refer to any color in the abstract. One cannot say, for example, "I like red things" or "do not eat red things in the jungle" in Piraha. Even the very idea of abstract representation is apparently impossible to explain to the Piraha. Everett describes his own attempt, quote, "If one tries to suggest, as we originally did in a math class, for example, that there is actually a preferred response to a specific question, this is unwelcome and will likely mean changing subjects and or irritation. As a further example of this, consider the fact that Piraha will write stories on paper I give them, which are just random marks, then read the stories back to me, i.e. just telling me something random about their day, etc., which they claim to be reading from their marks. They may even make marks on paper and say random Portuguese numbers while holding the paper for me to see. They do not understand that such symbols should be precise, demonstrated when I ask them about them or ask them to draw a symbol twice, in which case it is never replicated, and consider their writing as exactly the same as the marks that I make." Close quote. Abstraction is also absent from their art. The Piraha do not draw representational figures at all, except for crude stick figures used to explain to the anthropologists the spirit world, of which they claim direct experience. They cannot even draw straight lines. As Everett continues from above, quote, "In literacy classes, however, we were never able to train a Piraha to even draw a straight line without serious coaching, and they are never able to repeat the feat in subsequent trials without more coaching. Close quote. This is highly significant, given that the straight line is in itself an abstraction, being absent from nature. It is an abstraction, moreover, fraught with powerful cultural and psychological implications. At the most literal level, the Purana do not engage in linear thinking. The absence of linear thinking comes out in the language, which lacks tenses, not only in the morphosyntactical sense of conjugations and tense markers. There is simply no verbal way to fix an event at a specific point in the past or future. For Paraha doesn't have words for tomorrow, yesterday, next month, or last year. The sentence, "Let us meet here in 3 days," or even, "Let us meet here tomorrow," is inexpressible in Paraha. Paraha has only 12 time words at all, such as day, night, full moon, high water, low water, already, now, early morning, and another day. None of them allow the establishment of a timeline. Accordingly, the Paraha have no sense of history, no stories that reach back before living memory, and no creation myths. Paraha say, when pressed about creation, for example, simply, "Everything is the same," meaning nothing changes, nothing is created. They often do not know the names of their deceased grandparents. Their kinship terms do not apply to dead people. Theirs is a timeless world. The past, after all, is just another abstraction, as soon as it extends back before living memory. The Paraha similarly abstain from projection into the future, sharing with other hunter-gatherers the nonchalance and disdain for food storage described in Chapter 1. They are aware of food storage methods, such as drying, salting, and so forth, but only use these techniques to make items for barter. For themselves, they store no food, explaining to Everett, quote, "I store meat in the belly of my brother," close quote. In other words, says Everett, they share with those who need meat, never storing for the future. A further level of interpretation of this statement is also possible, however. Taken literally, it suggests a different conception of self-interest, and therefore a different conception of self. To help another is to help oneself. We are not separate. Like other hunter-gatherers, the Paraha have few material possessions, and those they do possess are very impermanent. Baskets that last a day or two, dwellings that last until the next storm. Their material culture makes no provision for security in the future, no provision for progress, betterment, or accumulation. A final refusal of separation lies in the Paraha's incapacity to form an abstract concept of value. Unable to understand money, they rely on barter for trade, and in these transactions tend to be painfully ingenuous. They present what they have to offer, Brazil nuts, raw rubber, and so forth, and point to items in the trader's boat until the trader says they are paid in full. There is little connection, however, between the amount of what they bring to trade and the amount of what they ask for. For example, someone can ask for an entire roll of hard tobacco in exchange for a small sack of nuts or a small piece of tobacco for a large sack. Yet the Paraha are intelligent people, skillful hunters and fishers, with a well-developed sense of humor. The main thrust of Daniel Everett's paper is to refute a widely accepted hypothesis in linguistics, Hockett's design features for human language, which lays out a dozen or so characteristics of human language it claims are universal. Paraha, says Everett, defies at least three of those characteristics. I believe that Hockett's design features only appear universal to us because of our present perspective of separation. Contrary to Hockett, Paraha is severely limited in its ability to speak of events removed in time and space from the act of communication, displacement, and in its ability to generate new meaning via grammatical patterning, productivity. All of this stems from the resistance of the Paraha to the distancing from reality that we call abstraction. From numbers to colors to time, there is much that the Paraha language is constitutionally unable to express, inviting the conclusion that the Paraha are a cognitively impoverished and socially isolated people. Moreover, theirs happens to have the fewest phonemes of any known language, just 3 vowel sounds and 7 consonants for women, 8 for men. Accustomed as we are to associating communication with semantic meaning, we can only conclude that the Paraha suffer an extreme poverty of communication. Of great significance, then, is Everett's observation that the Paraha communicate almost as much by singing, whistling, and humming, non-symbolic modes of voice communication, as they do by speaking. A rich prosody enhances their verbal communication as well. Could it be that they are closer to the original language than the rest of the world, mired as it is in representation and abstraction? Perhaps it is we, not they, who suffer a poverty of communication. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Cultivation and culture. Separation from nature and the technological program to control the world did not originate with agriculture, despite the eloquent arguments of Daniel Quinn and others who associate the expulsion from the Garden of Eden into the world of toil with the transition from a hunter-gatherer to an agricultural mode of existence. Agriculture, rather, marked an epical acceleration of a pre-established trend, an inevitable expression of a long-gathering latency. With agriculture, the separate human realm expanded into radically new territory to include the various animals, plants, and other parts of nature that we made ours. No longer was domesticity limited to the campfire circle. With agriculture, we began to domesticate the whole world. Because it was agriculture that launched the ascent of humanity into its present phase, the question of how and why agriculture began is critical. Many of the theories in the literature are unconvincing. The fallacy of the nasty, brutish, and short assumption of anxiety theory casts doubt on theories depending on population pressure and food shortage. Food production can sustain far more people per square mile than food gathering. Hunter-gatherers had the means to regulate their population levels, and in many places did so successfully for thousands of years. Population grew dramatically as a result of agriculture more than as a cause. Another theory is that climate change or increased CO2 levels at the end of the Ice Age rendered old lifestyles untenable and made new plants available. However, this ignores the rapid adaptability of hunter-gatherers, who inhabited a wide variety of ecosystems even before the end of the Ice Age, and in any event, the transition from one to another environment would seem much less difficult than the transition from foraging to farming. Most ridiculous are explanations that imply we only figured out the idea of planting seeds quite recently. Foraging cultures have a highly sophisticated understanding of plant reproduction and the conditions for their growth. The fact that agriculture arose independently in several locations around the globe points to a natural progression from earlier technology and mindsets, not an accident, whether mistake or glorious invention, that could just as well not have happened. Agriculture arose independently in Mesopotamia, in China, possibly in 2 locations, in South America, in Central America, in the eastern United States, and perhaps in New Guinea and sub-Saharan Africa. Indeed, most of the places where agriculture failed to develop were where there was a dearth of easily domesticable plants and animals. With few exceptions, wherever we could develop agriculture, we eventually did. Somehow, an agricultural future was built into who we were in the late Upper Paleolithic. Inevitable or not, agriculture was not a sudden invention, but the cumulative consequence of a series of incremental developments that marked a gradual shift in human attitudes toward nature. Although in our customary dualistic mindset, we may be tempted to see agriculture as an invention, a distinct epical transition. Jared Diamond plausibly describes the origin of agriculture as a gradual step-by-step transition from the hunter-gatherer lifestyle. At first, perhaps, nomadic hunter-gatherers merely followed the herds of the ancestors of modern cattle, sheep, and so on. Over many generations, these nascent herders began to provide food and protection at key moments, upon which the animals came increasingly to depend on. Crop planting may have started as a wider scattering of seed or removal of competing plants to give favorite foods a head start, followed perhaps by months of nomadic foraging for wild foods. Eventually, these plants came also to depend on the assistance of the planters, whether through deliberate breeding or unconscious co-evolution. In any event, the domestic corn plant cannot reproduce without human assistance, nor does a domestic chicken stand much chance of survival in the wild. Once domestication began, the much larger population density it permitted meant there was no going back. Agriculture, the archetype of human control over nature, induces dependency and the need for ever-increasing control over land, people, plants, and animals as the population continues to grow. Along with the gradual shift to agriculture came a transformation in human attitudes toward nature. Hunting accords with the view of other animals as equals. After all, nature works that way. Some eat and some are eaten. And the human hunter is doing nothing different from animal hunters. Domestication imposes a hierarchy onto the interspecies relationship as man becomes the lord and master of the animals. Understandably, this relationship is then projected onto the whole of nature, which becomes in its entirety the object of domestication and control. Yet we must also consider that the innovation of animal domestication could perhaps not have happened in the first place unless nature were first objectified conceptually. The solution to this chicken and egg problem lies in the embryonic self-other separation embodied in all life forms going back to pre-human times. Domestication merely represents its crystallization into a new phase, a slow-motion gestalt which also included all the other elements of separation detailed in the foregoing sections. The farmer's new relationship with nature engendered a new conception of the divine. As agriculture and other technology removed humans from nature, so also did the gods become supernatural rather than natural beings. The process was a gradual one, starting with ancient pantheons closely identified with natural forces. Gradually, identity evolved into rulership as gods were abstracted out of nature, eventually resulting in the Newtonian watchmaker god, completely separate from the earthly, the natural realm. At the same time, as we lost touch with nature's harmonies and cycles, the gods took on the capricious character exemplified by the Greek pantheon and the Old Testament. Accordingly, the gods must be propitiated, kept happy through the offering of sacrifices, a practice found in most ancient farming and herding cultures, but not among hunters. The angry god that arose in early civilizations is also linked to the concept of good and evil and the concept of sin. Corn is good, the weeds are bad. The bees are good, the locusts bad. The sheep are good, the wolves bad. Technology overcomes nature by promoting the good and controlling the bad. As for nature, so also for human nature, the self is divided into two parts, a good part and a bad part, the latter of which we overcome with the controlling technologies of culture. Whereas hunter-gatherers could easily adapt to all the vicissitudes of the local climate, farmers were at the mercy of drought, hail, locusts, and other threats to a successful harvest. While the resources of hunter-gatherers were virtually unlimited and their population fairly stable, agricultural civilizations experienced famines, epidemics, and wars that decimated whole populations and defied any attempt at prevention.
Here was a source of constant, inescapable anxiety woven into the fabric of life itself. No matter how successful this year's harvest, what of next year? As well as the motivation for the increased understanding and control represented respectively in science and technology. Scarcity and the threat of scarcity is implicit in the attempted mastery of nature. Jockeying for position in the face of scarcity, we endure an endlessly intensifying competitiveness that is built into our system of money, our understanding of biology, and our assumptions about human nature. Paradoxically, while agriculture raised nature's productivity of food for humans, it also introduced the contemporary concept of labor. Food was at once more abundant, but also harder to get. With agriculture, we had to work today to obtain food tomorrow. A primary example of the paradox of technology, which has brought us to the brink of catastrophe despite its motivating goals of ease, comfort, and security. Agriculture, because it involves keeping nature from its rest state, necessarily involves effort. I don't need to do any work to grow thistles, burdock, and crack grass in my garden, because that is what those 1,000 square feet of land naturally tend to. But to grow cabbages, kale, and garlic, I have to do all kinds of work, pulling up the plants that crowd them out, erecting fences to keep out the rabbits and woodchucks, etc. The truism that we reap only what we sow only goes back as far as agriculture. Before then, we could reap without sowing. Nature was fundamentally provident. For the hunter-gatherer, the providence of nature requires little labor or planning, but only an understanding of nature's patterns. Primitive survival is a matter of intimacy and not control. The advent of agriculture accelerated the demise of the gift mentality that characterizes hunter-gatherer societies. Whereas hunter-gatherers see game and food plants as gifts of the earth, a farmer tends to see them as items of exchange for labor, and it is always his goal to tilt that exchange constantly to his benefit. No longer is sustenance something that the world freely provides. Whereas the hunter-gatherer is part of the gift network that we call an ecology, the farmer separates himself from that network and seeks to extract what he needs from it. Thus, Daniel Quinn names the hunter-gatherers the leavers, and the agricultural society the takers, though perhaps givers would be a better word for the former. Eventually, the new relationship of taking and exchanging manifested among humans as well, setting the stage for the rise of money and property. When we need to apply effort to coax a livelihood from the land, humanity's relationship with nature tends to become adversarial. The land naturally drifts towards weeds, pests, and in general, a less productive default state. With the technologies of agriculture, we seek to prevent this from happening. The battle lines are drawn. Today, we seek to live more sustainably, yet the oppositional view of nature that environmentalists lament as the most destructive force on our planet is built into the very origin of civilization, agriculture. What else can we expect from a technology founded on arresting or reversing the processes of nature? Consequently, the end of humanity's war against nature must involve a wholly different approach to technology, and not merely better planning, fewer accidents, more foresight, and tighter control. Agriculture inaugurated our conception of the earth as a resource or asset, defined primarily by its productivity. The land gradually lost its intrinsic value, its sacredness, and assumed an extrinsic, conditional value based on what it could produce. For the first time, there was good land and bad land. The transition was a slow one, advancing each time new technology separated us a step further from original natural cycles. The primitive farmer is still very close to the land, even if less completely embosomed by it than the hunter-gatherer. Each new technological advance freed us from one or another natural limitation, culminating in modern industrial monoculture, in which we give the right inputs, almost anything can be made to grow on any land. Even a desert can be made to bloom. It is becoming increasingly apparent, though, that natural cycles can be ignored only temporarily. Their disruption bears consequences that can be postponed by a series of technical fixes, but never permanently denied. Deserts can be made to bloom, yes, but only at an increasing cost and not forever. Someday they will return to their natural state. Moreover, the consequences of the disruption of natural cycles intensify the longer it is sustained. The present accelerating desertification of the world's agricultural areas testifies to the impossibility of forestalling natural processes forever, and to the severity of the consequences of trying it. It is as if the desert cannot be denied. Oh, I have to break in here. There would be no desert if the initial plants and forests had not been cleared for agriculture. I continue. The valuing of land according to its productive function and not its innate sacredness projects onto human society in the division of labor. With agriculture, human beings began to be distinguished by function: farmer, soldier, metalsmith, builder, priest, king, in a way they never had before. True, there are chiefs and shamans in pre-agricultural societies, but with rare exceptions, they were not exempt from hunting and gathering food. They did not specialize by trading food for their services. In agricultural societies, people came to be defined more and more according to generic functional classifications, a trend that drew as well from the anonymizing effect of the vast increases in population density that agriculture permitted. With agriculture, a new category of being came into existence, the stranger. Before then, humans lived in tribes of at most 500 people, comprising bands of about 15 to 20 people each. It is not difficult to know 500 people by name and face, especially after a lifetime of frequent association. But beyond that, the identifying structures of kith and kin become tenuous, and some people necessarily fall into the category of other. In a hunter-gatherer band or tribe, even in a Neolithic village, we were intimately known by virtually everyone we had ever interacted with. Our acquaintances collectively embodied a tightly integrated web of relationships from which we derived our identity, our sense of self. We answered the question, "Who am I?" through relationships with people who knew us very well as unique individuals. But as the scale of society expanded, these personal relationships gave way to generic ones, ones governed by commerce, law, and religion. Accordingly, the sense of self came to depend on these structures as well, which are by their nature anonymous and impersonal. Relationships in primitive societies are guided by kin structures that provide each person a place relative to each other person. When society expands in scale to the point where two people are strangers, unable to place each other in their respective constellations of self, then there is a serious potential for conflict. Some kind of impersonal governance is required in the absence of structures of known relationship. After all, when someone is not self, then he is a potential competitor whose interests might be at odds with ours. Practically speaking, if someone is a stranger, there is no rational reason not to cheat him. Since he is not linked to your own social network, the consequences need never come back to haunt you. Hence the need for some kind of regulatory structure imposed from above. When hunter-gatherers from different bands run into each other in the bush, they immediately begin an urgent and very long conversation about who they know in each other's band, seeking to identify their relationship. Eventually, they establish that one is the cousin of the sister-in-law of the nephew of the other one's brother-in-law, effectively bringing each other into the same constellation of self. Vestiges of this are apparent when two strangers talk. You were in Taiwan? Hey, I had a classmate from Taiwan. Do you know so-and-so? When encounters between strangers are common, then some kind of governance is necessary, based not on the unique relationship as individuals, but on generic principles. All are equal under the law. Laws in the form of explicit codes are never found in pre-civilized people, nor are they necessary. It is no accident that as modern society grows increasingly anonymous, and as we pay strangers to perform more and more life functions, that the reach of the law extends further and further into every corner of life. Disputes that were settled informally a generation ago are today routinely administered according to written rules. Indeed, without some kind of formal standard, we would feel insecure, for we would literally be at the mercy of strangers. This trend is a necessary consequence of the alienation and depersonalization that began with agriculture. The division of labor introduced a new kind of anxiety into human life, rooted in the idea that you have to work in order to survive, a concept apparent today in the locution to make a living. Foraging peoples engaged in various arts and crafts beyond what was necessary for survival, the fashioning of musical instruments, for example, and there was surely some differentiation of skills and talents among them. However, food was always there for the taking, readily available regardless of prior planning or its lack. We typically applaud the agricultural surpluses that, quote, freed the non-farmer to specialize in other skills, close quote, not realizing that the non-farmer, lacking the means to obtain food on his own, was thereby enslaved to his specialization. Freedom is slavery. Art became profession, and its product became commodity. Work is nothing other than art diminished, degraded, and debased. Driven by economic necessity, a code phrase for survival, no longer could we work in fits and starts, and in these occasional efforts, develop considerable energy for a certain time. Even worse, art created in the interest of economics is no longer art, for good enough is good enough. Why make it any better when it is to be exchanged anonymously for food or money? When it is to be given over unto the other. In the early days, such exchanges were not completely anonymous. Money only partially replaced other forms of reciprocity, and most human interaction was not with strangers. Moreover, the life of the subsistence farmer is still intimately involved in the cycles of nature, wedded to the soil, and sustained only through a knowledge and respect for natural laws, rivaling a hunter-gatherer's. Indeed, for us moderns, gardening takes us much closer to nature, not away from it. However, once it started, the ascent of agriculture built upon itself. Technology advanced, the population grew, the regime of control intensified, and the conceptual dichotomy of human and nature widened. Finally, the institution of the machine that culminated in the Industrial Revolution completed the degradation of work from its original identity with art to the present condition of slavery. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein.
I'm just driving down this highway, past a shopping mall. I see billboard after billboard, hear the advertisers call. I see cars and I hear cars and I smell cars all just like mine. I see a world covered with asphalt, you're in parking lot G9. Just sprawling on forever, doesn't even have a name. It's a land where everything looks the same. See the signs rise high above us, flashing day and night, Verizon Wireless, Holiday Inn, Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola light. There once was grass here, maybe forest, but none of that's here now. It's just product after product, as much as time and space allow. My in Tennessee or Texas, Baltimore or Burlingame, I'm where everything looks the same. Ancient forests, family farmers, or the commons, heart of town. Does it make money? That's the question. If it don't, we'll knock it down. There's not a bicycle for miles, not a soul in sight that can't be seen behind a wheel, a few feet from the headlights. I don't know my neighbors, and I feel ashamed. Here where everything looks the same. If you don't like the Walmart, take these drugs, you'll feel okay. Now go sit behind the register and pass your life away. Eat these burgers from the factory, and if you should get fat, just give us some more money, and we've got some drugs for that. In this nation of individuals, is there one that we can blame? Why everything looks the same. As I'm driving past the clear cut with the brand new multi-cinema and the massive mural painting, the latest enema, I think of moving eastward, maybe Ghent or Amsterdam, far from Ronald McDonald and his greedy Uncle Sam, where life looks more like life and not some cardboard money game. Where everything looks the same.
The Machine. Lewis Mumford defines a machine as a combination of resistant parts, each specialized in function, operating under human control to utilize energy and to perform work, and makes a compelling case that the first machines were built not of metal or wood, but of human beings. Though this was an invisible machine because of the spatial separation of its human components, it was, in all of the above respects, the model for every machine built since, as these components, though made of human bone, nerve, and muscle, were reduced to their bare mechanical elements and rigidly standardized for the performance of their limited tasks. The products of these proto-machines are still visible today, most famously in the pyramids of Egypt. The machine enabled a new and profound expansion of the human ambition to dominate, subjugate, and eventually transcend nature. Agriculture set the stage for this ambition, it's true, but at the scale of the primitive farming village or herding tribe, humans were not really producing anything new under the sun. Ants, after all, engage in farming, and all creatures develop symbiotic partnerships with other species. Agriculture fostered the mentality of domination and laid the foundation for the division of labor, and it is these developments that transformed humanity into a new force of nature, or perhaps not of nature. In the pyramids was evidence that humans could perform superhuman, that is, godlike feats such as raising a mountain, and better than a mountain, a geometric shape of perfect precision. New Age pyramidologists who think that the ancient megaliths must have required the technology of an extraterrestrial or Atlantean civilization are right about one thing. Only through the mindset and method of machine civilization could they have been built. Yes, the pyramids were built by machines. Machines built not of metal or wood, but of human beings, fueled by the surpluses of riparian agriculture and molded by the forms of civilization into the standardized parts any machine requires. The specialization of labor in ancient Egypt was impressive even by modern standards. Mining expeditions alone employed over 50 different qualities and grades of officials and laborers. Truly, only a machine could build a structure nearly 500 feet tall out of 50-ton blocks transported from distant quarries. Blocks of stone were set together with seams of considerable length, showing joints of 1/10,000th of an inch, while the dimensions of the sides at the base differ by only 7.9 inches in a structure that covers acres. The base of the Great Pyramid is just half an inch from true level, and the sides are in near perfect alignment with true north, south, east, and west. In short, fine measurement, undeviating mechanical precision, and flawless perfection are no monopolies of the modern age. The tremendous physical energy to accomplish this feat, the specialization of function, the coordination of parts, and the requisite socio-technological infrastructure are the hallmark of the machine. Because the operator of such a machine could perform godlike feats, it is no wonder that in ancient civilizations, from Egypt to China to Mesoamerica, the king was accorded divine status. The ancient megaliths were proof that the king was not subject to the ordinary constraints of nature. Who else but a god could raise a mountain or change the course of a river? Of course, as long as human beings formed the parts of the machine, these divine powers, the power to transcend nature, accorded only to its operator, the king. But later, as new machines were built along the same principles and logic as the prototypical labor machines, a new possibility arose in the minds of philosophers. Maybe someday there will be a king with the equivalent of hundreds of thousands of manpower at our command. At the same time, as one after another natural limit was transcended, the idea also emerged that we could in all some sense be gods. It's amazing how the characteristics of the gods of the Greek pantheon so closely resemble the ambitions of the technological utopia. They possessed immortality, eternal youth, and flawless physical beauty. They could travel at incredible speeds and fly through the air, and they possessed lordship over the processes of nature. As presaged by the semi-divinity of the Chinese emperors and Egyptian pharaohs, today we aspire through our technology to the status of gods. As we have seen, this ambition was implicit already in the drive to create the perfect image, as well as to reduce the world to representations, names, and numbers, susceptible to control by finitary means. The machine vastly accelerated these embryonic strivings, which were nonetheless crucial prerequisites for the development of mechanical technology. Prior to language, number, time, and other forms of symbolic representation, no one could even have conceived of a machine, which requires as a conceptual fundament and then vastly accelerates the objectification of the world. The regularity, standardization, and functional specialization of these flesh and blood machines constitute a huge step away from nature, which admits to none of these qualities. The worldwide age of the builders confirmed in the human mind that we were something different under the sun, producing works and utilizing methods found nowhere else in nature. True, this paradigm shift started with the first stone hand axe, which we recognize today as being in some sense an unnatural object, thereby confirming the prejudice that the human is separate from nature. But machines take the out-separation of human beings to a qualitatively different plane by producing artifacts beyond individual human capacity. Ensuing millennia saw a gradual progression of the division of labor, and thus the complexity of the mega-machine perfected in ancient times. Animal power, pulleys, screws, and wheels, iron and steel all enhanced our ability to dominate, cut, and control nature. But none of these developments in any way reduced the mechanical structure of society itself, in which each individual is but a resistant part, specialized in function. Resistant here means discrete, and specialized refers to the division of labor initiated by agriculture. For a machine to run smoothly and predictably, its parts must be standard and hence replaceable, features which contribute respectively to modern depersonalization and anxiety.